This weekend starts right after this.
As a small business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
The Medal of Honor roller coaster. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. First full weekend in June. Glad you're with us, and here's what we have for you this hour.
The military's most prestigious award can also be one of the most emotionally painful. We'll have stories of how some veterans struggle with it.
The plastics industry is pushing back against the new restrictions on things like bags and drinking straws. Hear the case it's making.
If you're constantly reaching for your smartphone, there's a better way to keep your mind occupied. And it's even being used in team-building exercises at work.
And today's young adults who appear willing to negotiate just about everything.
There's some anecdotes, there's some statistics behind this, but it's this, basically it's saying that younger workers, younger consumers, millennials, might be more inclined to negotiate on prices for goods and services and for job offers, salary, benefits, those sorts of things.
Andy Keschner at MarketWatch on why these young consumers can be such hagglers. His report in about 20 minutes. For those of us who are civilians, the Medal of Honor is a fascinating award. But for the servicemen who earn it, the medal is a loaded gift. It's a source of instant celebrity and an entrance into a world of opportunity and adulation. It's also a reminder of what is often the worst day of their lives. And it's a summons to lifetime of service from those who did something so courageous as young men, so at odds with their own chances of survival, that it was beyond what duty demands. It's a story by Michael Phillips, staff reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Michael, you wrote about one guy who went off to live in a cave after his service.
Yeah, that's Gary Bykirk. So he was a special forces medic in Vietnam. He was out in this outpost near the Laotian border, came under attack, just an overwhelming attack. He was shot 3 times. He was hit by shrapnel in the spine to the point where he couldn't walk around. So a couple of Montagnard troops carried him around from place to place so he could continue to treat people who were injured. So it's just an extraordinary story of valor on his part. And he came back from the war. He was, you know, feeling very angry, very alienated from society. He went and he lived in a cave. He moved into a cave in New Hampshire, got some camping gear, and just stayed there. And he would come in, you know, go into town every once in a while. He was in take seminary classes. He came out and got a message saying, you know, expect a call from the Pentagon, that he got a call saying you're going to get the Medal of Honor. So he went down to Washington, got his hair cut, got a uniform, went to the White House. President Nixon gave him the Medal of Honor, and then he went back to the cave. And he literally put the medal away in his duffel bag and did not look at it again for 7 years.
Wow. Explain how he feels or felt at the time with the medal, because then he started to asked to show up at events or give some remarks, as many Medal of Honor recipients do.
Yeah, Gary, you know, at first he moved into a cave to try to forget the war, and they bring him down to Washington and give him a medal for a war that he's trying to forget. And it's an overwhelming kind of thing for him. But like I said, he's a very interesting guy. And eventually, sort of around 1981, he'd already moved out of the cave. He'd married a woman who didn't mind dating a man who was living in a cave. And he started to do some veterans events, you know, some rallies. This was right when they released the Iran hostages. And, you know, he went to an event where they were both celebrating the fact that the Iran hostages had been released and, you know, protesting the fact that they had gotten such shoddy treatment when they came back from the war. And he was happy to speak, but he didn't want to wear the medal. And one of the other vets there said, you know, don't be so selfish, Gary. Wear it for us, not for you. And that sort of, I think, set him on a different path, where he realized that the medal was symbolic and could be helpful to him, but also to other vets. And he got very engaged after that in helping other people, you know, helping counsel alcoholics and veterans with PTSD. He became a middle school counselor. and spent his career in, you know, in with dealing with middle schoolers and their many issues. And eventually, he really came to embrace the medal. He got involved with the Congressional Medal of Honor Society. He helped develop a curriculum for schools to teach sort of civic values that are associated with the medal. So he turned the medal into something really useful for him and for the people around him, even though at first it was very off-putting for him.
Quite the 180. Wow, we're speaking with Wall Street Journal staff reporter Mike Phillips. He's written a piece about how America's highest award for combat valor is both a gift and a constant reminder of what's often the worst day of recipients' lives. And you heard similar tales, right, about other guys going through this.
Absolutely. I mean, people handle it in different ways. But like you said, it generally, you know, they were young men when this happened. They did something crazy when they were 21 or 22. And then the rest of their lives is marked by that one event, those 10 seconds or 10 hours or whatever it was that earned them the medal. And it can be very hard for some of them. Dakota Meyer, who's a Marine sergeant, he was a corporal in Afghanistan when he went repeatedly charging into enemy fire to try to rescue his friends. He was, you know, helped rescue a lot of people, but he lost members of his team. Or they were. It's not that he didn't do sufficient. You know, it's not that he wasn't up to it. It's that they were. You know, people get killed, and he couldn't rescue them. And that is the part that really hits him. And he hates the medal. He's had a hard time with the celebrity that came with it. It just reminds him every day that was the worst day of his life. And for him, it felt like a failure. He rescued a lot of people. He didn't rescue his team.
Yeah.
And so he rebels against the medal. He just says it makes him sick. He just can't think about it. He literally gave it to his daughter to play with, and he only sees it when she's playing with it.
How many Medal of Honor winners have there been, or are there still alive? If they track that,
they track that. Yeah, there are 70 who are still alive, and over the course of the history of the medal, which dates back to the Civil War period, there have been 3,506 medal recipients.
Wow.
3,505 of them were men. One was a woman, Mary Walker, who was a surgeon in the Civil War. She was a civilian. For a while, they took the medal away from her because she was a civilian, and then I think with Jimmy Carter, who made an exception, basically, to the rules so that she could still be a Medal of Honor recipient. So it's a small group, especially the living ones.
Yeah.
You know, 70 of them.
Thanks, Mike. Michael Phillips, staff reporter at the Wall Street Journal. 14 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business, but you don't have to take our word for it. Take Evan Lyles, CEO of Roush Enterprises, instead.
For the people that are involved in product development, there couldn't be more unique and exciting opportunities that are really going to shape the future of the world. It's a really exciting time to be in Michigan.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
Glad you're with us. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The businesses of the future are being built today, and Michigan is where they start. Learn more by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity. The backlash against single-use plastic has engulfed straws, bags, and takeout containers, but the plastics industry is pushing back, arguing alternatives can not only be worse for the environment, but also disruptive for businesses. More from This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
In the plastic bag wars, the industry is starting to fight back. Sabira Chowdhury of the Wall Street Journal has written about how trade groups are defending their straws and takeout containers and joins us now. Sabira, what steps are plastic makers taking to defend themselves?
Yeah, so as you know, there's quite a few bans that have popped up. Plastic bags have been a target for a long time, but now we're seeing straws and plastic takeout containers being targeted as well. And I think the plastics industry is just getting a lot more organized about their fight back. So they're commissioning studies, they're pointing to independent studies, they're kind of rallying their plastic members and saying, look, this is the information that you need to be talking about when you speak with policy makers. And I think We're just seeing a lot more travel by some of the trade associations. Their lobbying budgets have gone up. They're flying around the U.S. to talk to lawmakers and say, look, hold on, the picture isn't as simple as you think it is. So just maybe more concerted action, I think.
What are they saying about alternatives to plastic? How are they portraying things like cotton and paper?
Yeah, it's quite a confusing analysis, and I can't say after doing the reporting on this story, I know for sure what the right course of action is. But essentially, the plastics industry is saying, if you look at the entire life cycle of a product, if you don't just focus on waste, and when we look at the single-use plastic bans, they've largely tended to focus on the issue of litter, and particularly marine litter. And the plastics industry is saying, hold on, let's look at the entire process of greenhouse gas emissions and, you know, how much energy it takes to actually make a product, transport a product, how much food waste is using plastic cut down on. And if we look at everything together, they're saying that paper and cotton actually have an environmental impact that is more negative than plastic does.
We're speaking with Sabira Chowdhury of the Wall Street Journal. What are the trade groups saying about recycling?
Recycling is, depending on who you ask, recycling either works really well or it doesn't. The trade groups are saying, look, most of the problem is not with the plastics industry. Most of the problem is with consumers who aren't recycling. And they're saying all you need to do when it comes to products like plastic bags is make sure you drop them off at bigger supermarkets that actually have bins to specifically take these products in that can then be transferred to specialist facilities to recycle them. I think where it gets messier is takeout containers, which because they have food in them, can't be recycled. Straws are too small and cannot be recycled. So in those situations, it's a harder fight for the plastics industry because there isn't an obvious solution. You can't just say, look, if we educate consumers, we can get recycling rates up and this problem will go away. There you almost have to look at an entirely different solution. You have to look at maybe making a new product that could somehow be recycled despite the fact that it's so small or despite the fact that there's food in it. And it doesn't really look like that's happening.
Sabira, you are located in London. Is there a difference between the way Europe is approaching this topic and the way the U.S. is that you can tell?
I would say so. I think Europe is more is leaning more heavily on regulation, and I think the EU is kind of more trigger happy when it comes to regulation. The US historically has always been quite averse to passing big legislation, particularly federal legislation. You know, some states will try and roll stuff out, but we're actually increasingly seeing bans on bans. So now there are states that are saying we are going to ban local municipalities and local governments from actually banning straws or banning plastic bags. We don't want a patchwork of regulation where, you know, 50 different municipalities have 50 different approaches. We as the state want to make one rule that everybody follows. But a lot of the time, most states so far haven't actually banned single-use plastic items. There's only a couple that have banned plastic carry bags, for instance. Whereas in Europe, I mean, there's a long list of items that the European Union has now said will be banned by like 2025, I think it is. And it's things like cutlery and balloon sticks and just a whole list of single-use items.
That's Wall Street Journal reporter Sabira Chowdhury with This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka. 22 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
Thanks for being with us. Young adults from their early 20s to mid-30s are negotiating for goods and services like no generation before them. While they've been raised to fight their corner, millennials arguably also have more reasons than their older cohorts to bargain. Many are coping with rising student debts that have reached $1.5 trillion for all generations, a cost-prohibitive housing market, high rents, and wages that don't stack up next to Generation X and baby boomers. More from Andrew Keschner, reporter at MarketWatch. Andy, what are you hearing?
I mean, basically what I'm hearing, and this is, you know, there's some anecdotes, there's some statistics behind this, but it's this, basically it's saying that younger workers, younger consumers, millennials, might be more inclined to negotiate on prices for goods and services and for job offers, salary, benefits, those sorts of things.
And what makes this unique?
One of the things that makes this unique is kind of the motivating factor for younger folks. I mean, this is a generation of millennials that have lots of debt, lots of, you know, priced out of a house market in a lot of ways. So there's this push to find the best deal possible or to maximize the offer possible. And also, you know, overlay that with a really tight competitive job market these days that, you know, maybe they have a little bit more negotiating power on this, but they also, you know, they need that extra cash.
Is this a behavior that's learned at home generally?
Maybe yes, maybe no. You know, in some of the folks I talk to, these sorts of negotiating and haggling and stuff that their parents told them to do, but others no. And I think the internet has a lot to do with kind of spreading the word to people who might be less inclined to do it, to say, hey, you know, just because you know, this airline ticket costs X amount of bucks doesn't necessarily mean that you need to accept that at face value. There are other ways that, you know, maybe you can work out a deal or not, or if there's bad service, you could complain and see what you get.
Wow. I'm speaking with Andy Keschner, personal finance reporter at MarketWatch. He's got a piece entitled "Saddled with Student Debt and High Rents, Millennials Take Haggling to a New Audacious Level." All right, so this strategy then, say, for goods and services, what are they, or how are they starting the conversation besides saying, hey, I happen to be nice, give me a discount?
My sense was it wasn't something that, you know, folks were walking into, you know, like a Target and saying, I'll give you, you know, I'll give you $5, you know, off the list price. I think it was kind of in some more like informal settings and more like big ticket price expenses. One woman I talked to, she was saying that she always asks on big ticket things if she could work out pricing deals where she pays as much possible up front to expose, you know, to kind of avoid any debts and, you know, in any sort of added on installment fees, that sort of a thing.
As you point out in the story, like, this is not so easy sometimes. Like, if you're at a hotel and there are, you know, five people waiting behind you, haggling can be uncomfortable, I guess.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, it's not something that is, you know, for every place in every circumstance, but it's just trying to bring to attention, you know, that between the internet and between the motivating factors like, you know, maybe a tighter budget.
Thanks, Andy. Andy Keschner, reporter at MarketWatch. 30 minutes now after the hour on this weekend. First full weekend in June. Thanks for being with us. Gordon Deal, Jennifer Koschenka. Coming up this half hour, the money debate about indexing. Also, why knitting is getting renewed attention. And the groomsman who broke his arm right before his friend's wedding, and then his replacement who broke his foot 30 minutes later. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. The backyard grilling season is underway, especially with the arrival of June, but U.S. meat continues to come under fire. Dealing with raw meat, as you know, can be tricky, and not cooking it properly can be deadly. Recently, more than 62,000 pounds of raw beef products from Aurora Packing in Illinois were recalled due to concerns they may be contaminated with E. coli. Here's what to keep in mind this grilling season from Zlati Meyer, business reporter at USA Today. Zlati, what should we know about burgers and steaks?
Well, the burgers are obviously a classic American food, whether you buy them ready-made or make them in your backyard. They are a little bit more susceptible to danger than perhaps some other proteins that we Americans love to eat.
You know what stood out to me? That ground beef that you pick up in a store could come from 400 different animals?
Yeah, that is a very surprising number. That's the figure that experts like to quote. I mean, think about, say, a chicken breast, right? That's one item. You see it its entirety, but when something is ground up, it's coming from as many as 400 different cows, and of course with each of those cows there's a risk of maybe a little bit of contamination, pathogen, which of course if it gets in, the other 399 components presumably get contaminated. So that's one of the reasons why it's a bit of a Russian roulette.
Wow. Which is, I guess, to the point, why you're safer undercooking a steak, for example, than you are a burger.
That's right. I mean, there are risks of pathogens at steaks, too, but certainly with burgers, with all those many sources feeding into that one patty that you're putting on your bun under, say, pickles and mustard, it is a little riskier.
Wow. All right, so some of the other issues here with regards to grilling meat or what?
One of the classic problems is that people don't grill their burgers or heat their burgers, fry their burgers hot enough, and that, of course, is an important step because that's the opportunity to kill the pathogens, the bacteria that gets into your food. So think about 160 degrees Fahrenheit is sort of that magical number. And, of course, that's the internal temperature, not what's the edge of the burger, which, of course, is what's sitting on the grill. So the CDC and other experts advise that people use a food thermometer. That may not be something the average cook has in their home kitchen, but it's really something that's important to make sure that that burger is thoroughly cooked. Another thing that people might do is, you know, you're bringing in the patties from the kitchen outside to the person who's manning the grill. They grill it up, and then they put those burgers back on that same plate that several minutes earlier had been used for raw meat. Well, you're sort of reintroducing, if there's a pathogen there, on those now cooked burgers, and you're back to square one.
Yeah, you do have to pay attention. We're speaking with Lottie Meyer, business reporter at USA Today, and she's written a piece entitled, "Sorry, But You're Grilling Your Burgers Wrong." What does the beef industry say on its behalf here?
Well, the beef industry is always very quick to advise people to prepare their meat properly, to cook it to that magical 160 degrees Fahrenheit internal temperature. And they also talk about the importance of sanitization and, you know, just taking the precautions. And, of course, if a person does follow all the rules that the experts recommend, it can be a fine and wonderful and delicious backyard treat, Memorial Day weekend or beyond.
Give us numbers, by the way, on how much meat we actually eat in the U.S.
Well, Americans do love their meat, right? It's sort of that iconic American food, the burger. It's been imported to other countries and sort of still thought of as that all-American food, whether it was the cowboys in the Wild West that introduced it or just sort of that iconic American McDonald's experience. But we do love meat, and we do love burgers. And according to the USDA, Americans will consume more than 59 pounds of beef per person, and that's up from 54 pounds several years ago. So it's really something that we Americans love.
Is E. coli the most popular way we could get sick when it comes to undercooked meat?
That is one of the predominant ones. And one thing to remember about E. coli versus some of the other pathogens we talk about is E. coli can kill you. It's not like some of the other bacteria where it just, you know, sends you to the bathroom for an hour or gives you stomach aches. I mean, this really, there are examples of people who have died from E. coli. So that, too, makes the stakes a little higher.
Thanks, Lottie. Lottie Meyer, business reporter at USA Today. 21 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Glad you're with us. In the financial world, making money is the most popular pastime, right? But having a good argument is a close second. What do folks argue about? Jonathan Clements, founder of HumbleDollar.com, says one of the great debates is about indexing. Jonathan, set this up.
So one of the things you hear on Wall Street all the time is that the growth of indexing is endangering the market, that if too many of us go out and buy index funds or are simply looking to buy and hold stocks and mimic the performance of the market averages, that the market's going to become less efficient and less liquid, and it's somehow a danger to capitalism, the future of the world, pretty much everything. And really, you know, this is, Gordon, is total nonsense.
I suspect that's why you wrote about it. Didn't you say, what was the figure? Some like $30 trillion last year in what, stocks that moved or something like that? You were making that comparison between like active stocks and those in an index fund?
So what we've seen over the past decade or so is that people have pulled about $1 trillion out of actively managed mutual funds and put about $1 trillion into index mutual funds. And if you add up, you know, all the money in the U.S. stock market that is indexed, there's something like 30 to 40% of all U.S. stocks that now reside in index funds of some kind or another, either index mutual funds, exchange-traded index funds, or strategies being pursued by institutional money managers. But what you're concerned about is liquidity in the market and having an efficient market. It doesn't matter who owns stocks. It matters how much trading there is. And the fact is, last year, there was $33 trillion of trading in the U.S. stock market. You know, there has been no drop-off in trading, even as people have flocked to index funds. And in fact, the amount of trading in the U.S. stock market has actually risen 168% over the past two decades. We are nowhere near the point where the stock market is going to grind to a halt because too many people have too much money in index funds.
We're speaking with Jonathan Clements, personal finance expert, also founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. We're talking about indexing. As you point out, money managers would love it if we stopped indexing, right, and went to actively manage stocks.
When you hear all these complaints about index funds and what a danger they are to the market, what you're really hearing is Wall Street talking its own book. Because if you're a Wall Street firm, what you want is for people to trade. What you want is for people to buy actively managed mutual funds, because that is how the street makes money. You know, you go out and you buy an actively managed mutual fund, and you might pay 1% a year in annual fund expenses, plus the fund might incur another 0.5% per year in trading costs. Meanwhile, if you buy an index mutual fund, well, these days you can buy index funds that cost absolutely nothing. So yes, what Wall Street wants is to scare people out of index funds and into actively managed funds, or into actually buying and selling individual stocks, because that way their profit margins will be fatter. But guess who will suffer because of it? It'll be the individual investor.
Do you feel it is, what, just a select few managers who can consistently beat the market, or is that even a high estimation?
Well, if you look over the past 15 years, only something like 6 or 7% of funds in any particular fund category have managed to outperform their benchmark index over that 15-year period. So, yes, there are managers who do beat the market, but then you have the next problem, which is, can you identify these managers in advance? We can always pick out the winners in retrospect, but looking ahead, can you pick out the future winners? Mm. And the fact is, there is no surefire strategy for doing so.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business. But you don't have to take our word for it. Take Patty Poppe's, president and CEO of Consumers Energy, instead.
All of the innovation that's occurring around robotics, AI, it's happening here in Michigan. We have chemical companies, we have pharmaceutical companies, we have medical device manufacturers. Michigan is a magnet for innovators and dreamers.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
The focus of knitting used to be producing a hat, a blanket, or a sweater, and it used to matter that you knit them right away. Today, knitting companies and experts say it's about the journey, not the destination, and are promoting the craft as a way to keep phone-addicted hands and minds occupied, but calm. Knitters can now learn how to turn their work into meditations. It's a story by Ellen Byron, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Ellen, what have you found?
I'm finding that there's this new wave inside the knitting world, which is people knitting for the sake of knitting and not necessarily knitting to achieve a final product.
And why does this seem to be resonating?
Well, I think a lot of people are looking for ways to keep their minds and hands busy that don't, and in a way that doesn't involve a screen. And so companies are hiring, I found one knitting instructor who offers workshops, and this allows employees to learn a new way to relax that doesn't involve their email, social media, or any other digital distraction. It's just a way of unwinding.
Because your hands are doing sort of muscle memory stuff, so you're not really thinking about it?
Yes, eventually. You do learn muscle memory, and you get into what some people call the flow, where time just passes without you necessarily noticing it. I also found a woman who leads a session called Meditation, and she believes that once you really get the hang of some basic knitting, keep it simple, and then just knit for the sake of knitting.
Is it easy to do?
Well, I saw some frustration, certainly at the beginning of some of these sessions, but then ultimately you really did see people relax and unwind.
We're speaking with Ellen Byron, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. She's written a piece entitled, In Mindful Knitting, It's the Journey, Not the Scarf. So ultimately, is it designed to give you something to do at home, perhaps, instead of picking up your phone like on a weekend or later at night?
Yes, and there are places where you can go to try to form a knitting habit at home each day. One woman runs a website called Knit Om, which is taking some words from yoga, and she offers a commit to knit program where each day for 30 days you get an email from her encouraging you to knit for the sake of knitting and offering different ideas and tips on how to make that happen. But yes, this is one goal is just to knit for the sake of knitting a little bit each day as a way to rest your mind, rest your head, rest your hands, and then ultimately maybe you do get a scarf out of the deal too.
Thanks, Ellen. Ellen Byron, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. A best man broke his arm the night before his friend's wedding in England, only for his replacement to break his foot just half an hour later. 39-year-old Stephen Jackson snapped his humerus bone, falling off the bed as he and the groom, childhood friend Michael Jackson, prepared to turn in the night before the wedding. Stephen was taken to a hospital by ambulance, and another pal, 41-year-old Brendan O'Mara, stepped in as a replacement best man and began frantically writing a speech. 30 minutes later, Mr. O'Mara tripped on a pavement outside the hotel as he went for a cigarette and broke his foot. The same paramedics arrived at the scene to take the second best man off for treatment at the Royal Oldham Hospital, even put him in a ward adjacent to Stephen with the broken arm. Luckily, both friends made it to the big day at Chattertown Town Hall in Oldham, England, where Michael married 31-year-old partner Kelly. Stephen got to deliver the best man speech, changing the opening line to, I intended on getting drunk tonight, but ended up getting plastered, right? A reference to the cast on his arm. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. As a small business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.